You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin continues to struggle with racial disparities when it comes to the well-being of kids. According to a report out today, we'll talk to the director of Kids Forward about some possible solutions.
First, if you're having trouble finding a house or apartment that you can afford, you're not alone. Lots of low-income and middle-income Americans are in the same boat, with housing costs putting a strain on their budgets.
And things may be getting worse. A new report from the housing agency Freddie Mac shows a big drop in affordable apartment availability from 2010 to 2016. And here in Wisconsin's real estate market, home prices have been steadily rising since the Great Recession, with big jumps in some urban areas.
Our next guest says federal housing policy may be making things worse, and she's hoping some changes that will help make housing more affordable.
Michelle Dickerson is a University Distinguished Teaching Professor and Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. She's the author of Home Ownership and America's Financial Underclass, Flawed Premises, Broken Promises, New Prescriptions, and her forthcoming book is called The Neglected Middle Class, Inequality, Race, and the Looming Economic Crisis. Michelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again.
How big a problem, Michelle, is housing affordability for low and middle income Americans?
It's a significant problem, and I think we actually now can safely use the word crisis to describe what's going on with affordable housing. You know, when we typically think of affordable housing, at least, 15, 20 years ago, we thought of it for just the poorest of our Americans. But now it's affecting the very poor, the moderately poor, people that are just below the poverty line, and also the middle class. It's a crisis that's affecting a significant swath of America.
And sometimes in the past, it seems like we've had a problem with mortgages and home costs, but not renting, or vice versa. Now it looks like it's both. Rents are high and home costs are high.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that rents are actually soaring is because of home prices. So during the recession, we had far too many, especially middle-income homeowners, to lose their homes. They can't afford to buy a house because, as you just mentioned, in Wisconsin and across the country, housing prices are soaring. Well, guess what? If they can't afford to buy a house, they then enter the rental market. Because they're middle income, they can afford, they have a little bit more flexibility in where they can live than our poorest citizens, which means they're driving up the prices of rent. So they can't afford to buy a home because home prices are rising, but when they enter into the rental market, they cause those prices to rise too.
Are there some areas feeling this more than others? We hear about San Francisco's and Seattle's where costs are being driven up in part as a story of success in high-tech industries. Is this a really localized problem in some places, or are we seeing this in a lot of places in the country?
We're seeing it all over the country. I mean, there are some places where, and San Francisco is either the best or the worst, depending on how you want to characterize it, example. It is virtually impossible for a middle-income family to afford to buy a home in San Francisco. Now, that's not the case all across the country, but we are seeing larger percentages of both middle-class Americans and also poor, lower-income Americans. They can't find a place to buy, and they can't find an affordable place to rent. It's everywhere.
And a big question is, can I afford a place to live near, reasonably near, where I can, say, work?
Exactly. And so you have people, especially on the sort of the coast, having commutes of, in excess of an hour. That causes all sorts of problems, especially if we think in terms of a school teacher. So if you have a school teacher that works an hour from the school he or she teaches in, what that means is it's not likely that they're going to be able to come in before school for tutoring, stay after school for tutoring, or to go support their students in after-school activities. It has all sorts of collateral effects when people are having to live so far from where they work.
We're talking to law professor Michelle Dickerson from the University of Texas, looking at housing affordability and unaffordability, renting and buying in the United States. And Michelle, you look a lot at how things like federal tax policies and other policies help or maybe more often hurt the situation. What do you see as the biggest problems at the federal level?
The biggest problem right now is the mortgage interest deduction. If you look at the fact that we spend about $70 billion on the mortgage interest deduction, but we're actually subsidizing the housing cost of high-income Americans. And the reason that the benefit only goes to higher-income Americans is because you only get the mortgage interest deduction if you itemize your deductions. Most Americans, 70% of Americans, take the standard deduction. So the only people that are going to itemize are people that have a pretty significant sized mortgage and that they have enough interest that it would warrant itemizing rather than taking the standard deduction.
Right. The big argument for that mortgage interest deduction, as I've heard it, is it's for that family, say, who's right on the border of being able to afford that house. This gives them the extra little nudge, an extra little bonus on their tax bill that helps push them over the top and be able to buy that house. You're saying they're not the ones who are benefiting, really?
Those are not the ones who are benefiting. The ones who are benefiting are because the larger your mortgage, the more interest you pay, the more valuable that deduction is. If we are clearly skewing housing decisions by telling people who earn over $200,000, buy a big house, get a big mortgage, you get a bigger deduction.
Let's stay with this for a bit. What do you see as a policy fix to that? What could change so that this program that's supposed to target people in the middle class, maybe lower middle class even, actually helps them more than people who are wealthier?
Well, there are a couple of, I think, pretty quick fixes. And for the first time, I will say ever, and I've been studying this for a while, I feel somewhat more optimistic that we may have some modifications to the mortgage interest deduction. So you can deduct interest on up to $1 million of debt. Most middle-income families, poor families, they don't have $1 million mortgage. They don't pay interest on $1 million mortgage. So reduce, you know, cap the amount of the mortgage that you can claim interest on. Currently, you can claim interest on both your primary residence and a second home. Eliminate the provision where you're allowing rich people who have two homes to be able to deduct interest on their second home. I mean, those are a couple of just really quick tweaks that we should be able to do, and the majority of Americans will not be harmed.
That's aimed at the middle class. Now, let's look at lower income people. When people think about government affordable housing programs, that's maybe what they think of, Section 8 housing. You've talked lately, you were on a panel for members of Congress recently talking about some related issues here, misconceptions that people in the public, maybe even policymakers, have about who is getting this Section 8 home support for low-income people.
Exactly. And even when you say the term Section 8, in people's minds, they have this vision of who the person is that's receiving this housing choice subsidy. They think they're lower income. They think they're a person of color. They probably think they're black. And they also think that they're receiving this housing handout because they refuse to get a job. And as I said in the congressional briefing I recently participated in, only one of those things is true. You're right. For a person to receive a housing choice voucher, they have to be poor. But more than 50% of the people that are, you know, Section 8 tenants are white, and 70% of the people who receive this housing subsidy either currently work or have recently worked. So it's not that they're getting an unearned handout. They're actually, these are working members of our communities.
Does this kind of housing assistance for low-income people actually help them find decent housing?
For those that are actually able to get the voucher, yes, it typically has. The problem is most people that are eligible to receive the housing voucher aren't able to get it because there's just not enough money to fund the program. And the other challenge is something that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, that we are having fewer low-income housing units to actually be built. So we have a challenge of the renters. You know, the renter market is being flooded by mid-income people who lost their homes, and there's just not enough of the affordable housing being built. And so even the people who have the housing choice vouchers may not be able to find a place to live.
Law professor Michelle Dickerson is with us from the University of Texas. We're looking at the high cost of housing in the United States, renting and buying, and why home ownership and rent payments can be a big burden for low and middle income Americans.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Have you had trouble finding housing that you can afford in the community you want to live in? What role, if any, should the government play in helping provide affordable housing? You can call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're continuing our conversation with law professor Michelle Dickerson at the University of Texas, looking at the high costs of rent and home ownership.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is this your life right now, trying to find housing, a rental, or buying a house that you can actually afford? What's happening in your community when it comes to the costs of housing? Are you commuting longer, a lot longer than you would like to, maybe? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michelle, before we go to our callers, are there ethnic and racial disparities when it comes to housing and housing policies, for that matter?
Well, there are clear disparities, at least with respect to the mortgage interest deduction and home ownership rates. As I mentioned earlier, the taxpayers who are most likely to take the mortgage interest deduction are higher income taxpayers. Because white families have higher household incomes on average than black and Latino families, what that means is it is statistically more likely that the person that takes the mortgage interest deduction that benefits from this $70 billion housing subsidy will be white. And also, if you just look at sort of our nation's not really good history with respect to housing, after World War II, after the Depression, when the United States was engaging in really massive efforts to get Americans into homes, the Americans that were able to buy homes and were able to move to the suburbs to buy high appreciating homes were white Americans. Redlining and a lot of other federal policies kept blacks out of the home buying market at that time, and as a result, they've lost decades of wealth.
Is there a way to turn that around in the short term?
Not in the short term. We're not going to sort of undo 50 years of wealth loss, but one thing I'll stress is we don't need to continue to make it worse. So to the extent that the mortgage interest deduction in its current form is making it worse, at a bare minimum, we need to stop that and then try to work on policies to close that gap.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in northern Minnesota. David, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of questions. First one is where your guest gets the figures. Most homeowners who own their own homes have incomes slightly below $50,000 a year, and that certainly seems to be a reasonable income to have a home. The second thing is I do not understand why or how removing a tax deduction on a second home is going to help the low and middle income people get a home who currently do not have a home. That's if your guest wants support from a wider audience to enable low income people to get homes, goring the ox of the people who have a second home by taking away that second mortgage just doesn't make any sense at all.
David, thanks for calling in. So let's start with that second point. David's saying don't take away the mortgage interest deduction on those second homes. He doesn't see how it connects to helping people who can't afford a home.
Well, the connection is, I'm actually glad he asked that question. The connection is until we eliminate some part of the $70 billion that we're currently using to subsidize housing, Congress simply isn't going to have the will to allocate more funds to low-income housing. I mean, it is a zero-sum game. If they're spending $70 billion, which they're currently spending on the mortgage interest deduction. They're not also going to spend $70 billion as a tax expenditure for low-income housing. If I thought they would do both, I would agree completely with the caller, but I think it's just a reality that they're not. The amount of money that they've allocated now for low-income housing is less than half of the amount that we spend on the mortgage interest deduction.
And then David said most or many homeowners are earning $50,000 or less. I don't know what the numbers are on that, but if that's the case, those are people who wouldn't probably be helped by the mortgage interest deduction because they'd be taking the standard deduction.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, David, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michelle Dickerson, professor of law at the University of Texas, looking at the costs of housing, housing affordability, or lack of same. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're going through this, having trouble finding some place to rent or buy that you can afford. Back to our callers now, Bob in the Mount Horeb area. Bob, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Michelle, I don't know if you speak about this in your book or your work, but property taxes are forcing homeowners out of their homes. And property taxes in Madison are a definite burden to a homeowner. You got to come up with almost $5,000 for a decent home. That's around $225,000 or more. And then when they reassess property.
Oop, I think we lost you, Bob, but I think we got your point. Michelle, Bob saying property taxes are a part of the affordability problem. Where do they fit in?
It clearly, definitely is a part of the affordability problem. And if we can sort of link back to places like San Francisco or places where home prices keep increasing, it's great for the existing homeowners that, A, see their wealth increase, and, B, can afford to pay the property taxes on the homes. For people who can't and they want to sell their homes, they may not be able to buy anything in their area because of the fact that property taxes are increasing. So he makes a great point. The crisis is both related to property taxes increasing. It's related to housing prices increasing. And also one thing we really haven't talked about, it's related to the fact that for most middle-class workers, they haven't seen a significant raise in decades.
Thanks a lot for that call. We also heard from Dennis, who couldn't stay on the line. Dennis says he's in the lower class income level. He was weighing renting versus buying, decided it made more sense to buy, but partly because of his income level, he was held back from buying something and getting that mortgage because of his credit score. So let's talk about credit as part of this equation on finding housing, Michelle. Where does that fit in?
Well, one of the other things that happened in the recession is a lot of people who defaulted on mortgages or who are in default now on their student loans, they have bad credit. So I'm not suggesting that we do the same thing that caused the housing bubble to burst to begin with. We don't need to create mortgage products that get people into homes only to have them lose the homes in 2 or 3 years. But we do need to take care with what's included in a credit score. And if there are things that really have little to do with the person's ability to qualify for a loan and to repay the loan, we need to make sure that what's included in your credit score is not holding you back.
And let's throw in another kind of loans, student loan debt. That's been cited as a factor that's preventing people from home ownership. How does that prevent people from getting into housing?
Not only is it preventing people from home ownership, it's preventing the people that should be buying homes. So recent college graduates, or the trajectory 20 or 30 years ago is you graduate from college, you get married, you buy a home, or you get married, you have a child, you buy a home. The problem now is a lot of, especially the millennials, can't afford to buy a home because they're buried in student loan debt. Both, and it's especially a problem for people who attended college but didn't graduate. So they're stuck with the student loan repayments, but they didn't get the income boost that they would have received if they'd stayed in college for all 4 years. So if you're buried in debt with your student loans, you're not likely going to be able to, or you're not likely going to want to, take on mortgage debt.
Michelle, you started to touch on this earlier, but do you see an appetite out there to solve the problem of housing affordability? Obviously, a lot of individual people are feeling this. Is it emerging as a policy issue that lawmakers want to tackle?
It is. And I've been talking about sort of the mortgage interest reduction and why I felt we needed to that as a matter of policy, we needed to modify it for decades, over 10 years. And usually I'm lined up on the opposite side from the home builders, the mortgage bankers, and the realtors. For the first time ever, the builders and the mortgage bankers are willing to talk about potential modifications to the mortgage interest deduction. Now, the realtors are still on the other side, but this is a seismic shift to have these two national organizations saying, look, this is a crisis, and we need to be creative in how we're going to fix it.
And do you see other people starting to agree with you that, apart from the groups you just mentioned, that this is a crisis situation and should be treated accordingly?
Yes, and the interesting thing is it's both from the left and the right. So traditionally, when the sort of small band of us would say that the mortgage interest deduction isn't good, usually the response is, but it helps people buy homes. We now know that's not true. Rich people will buy homes with or without the deduction, and people that take the standard deduction don't get any benefit from itemizing. And we also see now the quite stark wealth inequities, both between the middle class and the upper class, and also between white homeowners and Black and Latinos who either are homeowners or can't afford to buy homes. So I think there's I'm more optimistic now, not completely, but I'm more optimistic now that there may be some more of an appetite in Congress to look at this, because the affordability crisis is just that. It's not just affecting the poor. It's an American crisis.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Michelle Dickerson, law professor at the University of Texas and author of the book Home Ownership and America's Financial Underclass, Flawed Premises, Broken Promises, New Prescriptions. She joined us for a look at the high cost of housing. Now, Wisconsin continues to struggle with racial disparities in child well-being, according to a new report released today.
The first Race for Results report was published in 2014. In it, the well-being of African-American kids in Wisconsin came in last. This year, it ranked slightly higher at 41 out of 44 states surveyed. Beyond that, the report also showed that other children of color face significant barriers as well.
Ken Taylor is the executive director of Kids Forward, which is formerly the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks, and I appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
So one of the big headlines on this, Ken, was Wisconsin's disparity now, the gap between mostly white and African-American kids was the widest in the nation. Can you talk about that finding?
Sure. And that's unfortunately, that was also the case in 2014 when the first version of this report was released. And so that's one thing that is similar between last time and this time. And we see the way that this report is created is they look at 12 different indicators and then combine them together and look at the overall well-being of kids. And when we do that, we find that there are huge disparities between white kids here in Wisconsin and kids of color in general, and the biggest gaps are between white kids and African-American kids in Wisconsin.
Among those measures, where do we see the biggest gaps?
Well, some of the things that we're most concerned about are around income and poverty. And so, for example, one of the data indicators is children who grow up in families that are at twice the poverty line, and that's what's considered appropriate to raise a family on. And so that's the indicator they use. And for white kids, 72% of white kids in Wisconsin live in families above 200% of the poverty line, compared to just 24% of African-American kids, 30% of Latino kids, and half of Asian kids. But when we break it down by subpopulation within Asian kids and Asian populations, we find that there's big disparities there as well. So only 32% of Hmong kids in Wisconsin are at that 200% of the poverty line. And then American Indian kids, just over a third, 36% of them live at that, are in families above 200% of poverty. So we know the long-term impacts of kids growing up in poverty has detrimental effects long into the future, and so that's one that we're really concerned about.
Right. We can look at some of the other measures in a bit, but how much of those other measures, how much of other problems we see starts with that huge disparity in income?
Right, and I think that that's a great question, and all these things are interconnected, and they're complex, and you know the cause and effect is complex, and so you know is the poverty related to the education in the previous generation, or you know yes, you know and health and things like that, and so all of these things are interconnected, but there's no question that the fact that we have these huge disparities in income and poverty. Are one of the main factors.
I mean, is this a never-ending cycle? A low income leads to worse educational and other outcomes for kids who grow up as adults who have low income and raise kids with the same situation. I mean, how do you start to break that cycle?
Well, this is something that is you know created by people, and so we can change this. This is not something that is completely beyond our control, like the weather. And so, you know, these conditions that low-income families find themselves in are a lot of it has to do with the systems that people create. And so I would argue, I wouldn't say that it's easy, but it's not a never-ending cycle. And we actually know some things that we can do. And so we know that investing in education, particularly in the early years, has a huge impact. So there are things that we can do. And unfortunately, in too many cases, we're choosing not to do them. We're making choices and investing or not investing in things that we know make a difference. But this is not inevitable.
Talking to Ken Taylor, executive director of the group Kids Forward, looking at the new Race for Results report, looking at the overall well-being of Wisconsin kids across the country for that matter, and at disparities by income level and by racial and ethnic groups in the state. Ken, since that original report in 2014, have we seen good news? Have we seen signs of improvement here in Wisconsin?
So overall, I wish I could say the answer to that is yes. But I really can't. So that we still have these huge gaps that we need to really take on. And there are different efforts that are taking place in different parts of the state that need to be applauded. And so there are people that are working hard on this. But this is a multi-generational challenge. We have to address it both with a sense of urgency, because there's kids who aren't going to be ready for kindergarten, and they're not going to get a second chance at that. So we have to work urgently. But we also know that this is the great American challenge. And so we have to have a long-term commitment. And we know to make real change, it's going to take more than the 3 years between the first report and the second report. That said, there are some indicators where in some places in the state we are making some progress. In Madison, for example, there's been a concerted effort around high school graduation, and in some of the high schools we've seen some positive trends. We need to continue to watch that to make sure that that's an ongoing thing. We've seen some small decreases in teen childbirth or increase in those who are delaying childbirth, so that's some good news. And then we've also seen some small increases in for African American young adults in their completion of associate's degrees, and so those are important things to highlight that we can make progress on these things. But the changes need to be we need to invest more, and we need to think over the long term and not just say, okay, we made this little change over this period, and so now we're done.
We keyed in some on the income levels as one of the measures in this report. What are some of the other findings that struck you, that worry you, that were maybe the same or worse than they were in 2014?
Yeah, so unfortunately, one of the things that we can't compare, just because of the way the data is created, is around high school graduation rates, but that's another one of those sentinel indicators. And so, you know, we're really concerned. So I can't say how this changed from the first report, but I can say that, again, we see significant racial disparities in high school graduation. For white kids, we have a high rate of 93% graduating on time. For American Indian kids, that's 78%. For African American kids, that's 64%. So that's one area. But one of the things that I think it's really important for listeners to understand is earlier on, one of the things that we're really concerned about is fourth grade reading scores. And so those are low across the board. And that's really important because we know the educators say that up to, you know, through third grade, kids are learning to read. And subsequent to that, they're reading to learn. And so if you're behind in reading by fourth grade, it's really hard to stay up with your peers. And that the reading proficiency level across all racial and ethnic groups is low. So the statewide average is 37%, meaning only 37% of fourth graders are reading at the fourth grade level. And then when you break it down by race, you know, it's even more troubling. Only 11% of African American kids, 19% of Latino kids. And so that's something that I think all of us need to be really concerned about, you know, across all racial demographic, geographic, and income levels. And it's that's one of the reasons why I think it's so important to invest in education in the early years to turn those numbers around for everyone.
We're looking at the findings of the latest Race for Results report, which finds big racial disparities among kids in Wisconsin. Ken Taylor's with us. He's executive director of the group Kids Forward.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Families and teachers, we want to hear from you. What kinds of challenges are there for children of color in the state? And what can we do to help all of Wisconsin's kids succeed? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we're looking at the racial disparities among kids in Wisconsin and in the country with Ken Taylor. He's the executive director of Kids Forward.
We're looking at a new report on the well-being of kids, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think Wisconsin is doing well to help children succeed at all of all races and of all ethnic and economic backgrounds? Where do you see room for improvement? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ken, a couple times you've mentioned early child education. How are we doing on that in Wisconsin? What's the state of pre-kindergarten education?
Yeah, so it's really a mixed picture across the state. So we have a lot of early childhood service provision in a bunch of different kinds of programs. So, you know, many people know about Head Start. We also have 4K that's both in the schools and served by private agencies. And one of the main things that we work on here at Kids Forward is around high quality early care for birth to 5-year-olds. And that is for low-income folks. That is subsidized through a program called Wisconsin Shares, and we have historically had a robust early learning system. But over the last few years, there's been some real challenges. There's been a significant decline in the level of public support for early learning. So we invest $100 million less now than we did 8 years ago, and so I have some real concerns about that, because we know that it's a challenge for families across the income spectrum to get high quality early learning for their young kids, and it's particularly challenging for low income families. And so I think that we need to invest more in that, and we need more in higher quality. And the public systems are working on that, but we need to do better.
We'll go to our callers now. We'll start with Sharita in Madison. Hi.
Hi. This is an awesome discussion. Like, it totally goes down to the simple fact that, you know, Scott Walker and everything that kind of goes along with his agenda kind of puts the black people in Wisconsin in a poor position. I just think that knowing that people are not eligible to make enough money to pay for the housing that's really high in Madison. And then, you know, the kids kind of have to worry about having somewhere stable to live and, you know, a place to go after they get out of school. And when they're at home, they don't really get a chance to sit down and read or practice on, you know, what they've learned in class, because even at school, they're probably worried about, you know, where they're going to go at night. And sometimes it just kind of takes a back seat to kind of the reality of this situation.
Sharita, thank you so much for calling. And Ken, if children have housing insecurity, food insecurity, I mean, that's going to put them at a big disadvantage when they're learning.
There's no question that that's a huge challenge. If you're a kid and you don't have a sense that you know where you're going to sleep at night, or if you don't have a quiet place to read or study, or if you go to school hungry, it's going to be hard to concentrate and hard to make progress. And I would say also that this is a long-term challenge, and you know, there are things that are happening currently politically that I think are making this challenge much more difficult, and we need to take a look at that. And these are also challenges that have been making in, you know, long time in the making, and so we need to come together around the investments that we need to make to address them.
Thanks for the call, Sharita. We'll go next to Jill on the line in Milwaukee. Jill, hi.
Hi. I appreciate your covering this topic. I am a former teacher, and I also have a relative who came home the other day and just finished testing for reading levels. There is a student in eighth grade who tested at the pre-5K reading level, not a special ed child. Students have been pushed through just consistently, and I saw this also when I was in teaching. It was part of the reason that I left. It wasn't doing a service to them at all.
Jill, thanks for the call. Ken, a discouraged teacher there, seeing these kind of results. What do you say to her?
Well, I sort of appreciate that you know, that she did, you know, is a teacher and worked hard on that, and you know, understand the frustration. And so one of the things that I think is really important to say to teachers and to all of us is that a lot of these challenges are outside of the schoolhouse doors, and so you know, we need to better support teachers and better support our educators. And we have to do more outside of school, because there's only so much that they can achieve and so much that they can do in the time that they have with the students. And so when we see these sorts of challenges, yes, we need to challenge our educators, and we also need to know that, like we were saying earlier, the early years, the poverty, the point that Sarita brought up around housing insecurity and education, all these things are interconnected. And so we have to do better on all these fronts.
Jill, thanks for that call. And Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ken Taylor. He's executive director of Kids Forward. He joined us today to look at why the racial disparity gap when it comes to children's well-being has been so hard to close, and look at what's being done to improve that situation here in Wisconsin.
Now, it's been 10 years since a bat-killing fungus was discovered in the northeastern United States. That fungus and the disease it causes, known as white nose syndrome, is now found in 31 states, including Wisconsin. While efforts to find a cure or a treatment are moving ahead, bat populations continue to decline. Chuck Kornbach reports.
An underground waterfall gurgles in Laurel Caverns, a large cave system about an hour south of Pittsburgh. Nearby state of Pennsylvania, wildlife biologist Greg Turner says these and other local caves were once a popular wintertime home for bats. That was before what's known as PD fungus spread into the caverns.
We'd see sites with 100,000 bats, so we'd see clusters of 8,000-10,000 bats sometimes. It would form these big, long patterns of aggregated bats. It was pretty neat to see that.
But then, Turner says, the PD fungus led to white nose syndrome developing in many caves in the Northeast and later the Midwest. Scientists speculate the fungus causes breathing problems and other irritation that make the hibernating bats wake up and expend too much energy during cold weather. Millions of bats from several species have starved or frozen to death. Turner says that was a big shock to cave researchers, too.
That was what I always told the folks that were getting recently infected. I said the hardest part is watching all of those bats that you used to see and count, and then watching it go down to zero.
Scientists say the loss of large numbers of insect-eating bats threatens to make pest-related problems worse for farmers. Pollination and fruit seed distribution could also be harmed. Some state agencies have restricted human access to caves to try to reduce the spread of white nose syndrome. Commercial cave owners have made changes too, but Laurel Caverns spokeswoman Lisa Hall says it doesn't look like the new procedures have helped much.
But I'll never forget the owner. When we had our first talk and we realized this was coming, I'll never forget the look he gave me. Just kind of a look of hopelessness.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is coordinating the national response to white nose syndrome. Communications officer Catherine Hibbard says the bat situation is bleak, but not without hope of a treatment or cure. Hibbard says it's just hard to say when there will be success.
They are in the initial stages, so it will take a while, and it's also, you think of a wild populations for bats, they're very difficult to treat.
Hibbard praises Wisconsin scientists for being good partners in the national effort and willing to take on some of the experiments. The U.S. Forest Service is announcing this week that one of its Madison-based researchers is getting a $150,000 grant to explore the use of ultraviolet light to try to help a species called the little brown bat. Plant pathologist Daniel Lindner says a lab study has tentatively found that a low dose of a type of UV kills the PD fungus.
That the UV light actually affects the DNA that's in the cells and damages it. And so if the DNA gets damaged enough, the cells die.
Lindner says this winter he and scientists from the Wisconsin DNR will go to a cave in northwestern Wisconsin, collect 45 fungus-infected little brown bats, and drive them to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, where the bats will be exposed to UV light. If that test works and monitoring shows the bats aren't harmed, Lindner says it's possible scientists may eventually install UV light rings at cave entrances and treat the bats in flight. The Fish and Wildlife Service says a Trump administration budget proposal could eventually cut funding for white nose syndrome in half. So this week, just ahead of Halloween, bat supporters are reaching out to members of Congress to urge backing of continued research. It's part of the annual Bat Week activities coordinated by Bat Conservation International. Chuck Hornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.